Hi, and welcome to the launch of the report, Governance and Policy Changes During Times of High Influxes of Protection Seekers. My name is Kristin Talge, and I'm an advisor at the Norwegian Institute of Urban and Regional Research at Oslo Metropolitan University, and I will be your host today. This report is the first of its kind in Europe. It compares the responses of 8 European countries: Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, the UK, Germany, Austria, and Poland, to the high influxes of protection seekers this past decades. It includes updated analysis of policy responses until June 2023. Before we present the report, here with me I have Halvan Ibrahim, Assistant Director at IMDi, the Directorate of Integration and Diversity in Norway. It is IMDi which has commissioned and financed this report. Thank you, Halvan, for coming.
Thank you very much, Kristin, and it's a pleasure for me to be here.
That's really good. Mm. So why did IMDi commission this research project?
Let me start with who is IMDi. IMDi is the Norwegian Directorate of Integration and Diversity, and we are a government agency under the Ministry of Labour and Social Inclusion. We are responsible for implementing the government's integration policies. And we work to strengthen the municipalities, other government agencies, and local authorities in the field of integration and diversity. An important part of our job is to ensure that our policies is based on knowledge and research. So therefore IMDi keeps track of ongoing research projects, surveys, statistics, and we do our own studies and analysis of migration and integration related topics. We also commission studies, evaluations, and research projects as this project. We want some updated info or research on the fields that we are working with. The idea behind the Govern project itself came in 2022, that was because that the situation was very special. Europe again was facing a very special situation with a high influx of asylum seeker arrivals, it was a result of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And both the ministry and IMDi, we saw that we need to gather some more information about how the situation is in the different countries in Europe. We need to gain some insights on how other countries handled and responded to the high influxes. And we had mainly two key questions. The first one was that whether large influx produced similar responses in the different countries, or whether other countries reacted different and with different means. And the second question was that if there is something that we can learn from other countries in Europe.
Yes, and now going forward, how will Norwegian authorities use the findings from this research project?
The results of this project is a unique comparative analysis of government responses both in 2015 and 2016 and 2022 and 2023 and policy development in eight countries and the format and the scope of the project with the comparative analysis over a very long period and comparing 11 policy areas and in eight countries. It's groundbreaking both in a national and in an international context. The project has set a high standard both when it comes to the knowledge that it produced and to the method that it used. We hope it will inspire for more similar studies in the countries that are involved or other countries also. For Norwegian authorities, both the findings from this project and future projects will ensure that we learn more about policies in other countries and in Norway, which means that works better, so we can ensure that we have policies that are up to date and effectively enough to handle the situation.
That's good. Well, thank you very much, Halvor, for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, next we have Vilde Hernes. She is senior researcher at the Norwegian Institute for Urban and Regional Research. She is also the project manager, and she's going to give us a summary of what they have found out. First, she will address topics concerning asylum and immigration. Then we will have Frode Forfang, director at UDI, the Norwegian Directorate of Immigration, who will give his comments. After, and then Vilde will continue with the second part of the report concerning integration measures and overall trends. After that, we have Thomas Liebig, senior migration specialist at OECD, who is going to share his thoughts with us. At the end of the webinar, Vilde will come back and she's going to look at and discuss some dilemmas going forward. So, Vilde, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So, what are the similarities and differences in European governance and the governance and policy development before, during, and after the high influxes of protection seekers in 2015-16 and 2022-2023? So, this is the overall research questions that we have aimed to address in the Governing Project. And it's a rather complex and ambitious comparative strategy that we use because we compare no less than four dimensions, you can say. So, we compare analysis of eight European countries, we compare 11 policy areas, and we compare over the time over one decade, but during two influxes. And it's important to mention that the data collection we have is up until June 2023. As we know, there is a lot of ongoing policy developments in this field. And we also compare between different subgroups of protection seekers to see if there are different rights and restrictions for different subgroups. So one of the strengths of the report is that we cover governance and policy developments within 11 different policy areas. So this wide list of areas that you see here. And our aim has been to provide both more insights into each of these areas, but also to see the connection and the interdependencies between these different policy areas and in the analysis. Further, although we have tried to get into the nitty-gritty details at times, the large comparative scope and the report brought forward the need to have some larger dimensions that we can compare across between different policy areas. So based on existing research, we compare across policy fields and ask, are the policies becoming more restrictive or liberal? Are they becoming more universal, meaning that they're the same rules applying to all protection seeker groups? Or are they more selective, differentiating rights between different groups? And do they become more temporary or permanent? Which relates to whether policies have a short or long-term perspective on the protection beneficiaries' stay in the host country. So, shortly about the team and the research design. So, we include 8 countries that differ on relevant characteristics and contextual factors that could have an effect on how governance and policy developments and whether they are unitary or federal states, type of welfare regime, and whether they are part of the EU, Schengen, or the Common European Asylum Agreement. So, to ensure country expertise, I have been fortunate enough to lead this amazing team of European scholars with in-depth expertise within their respective country. So I just want to use this opportunity to sincerely thank all of the project members who have been part of this and our partner institutions who have done this project within a limit of 7 months. So we started in April 2023 and we handed in the report in late November 2023. So a sincere thanks to all of you. So what have we done during these 7 months? So first of all, NIBR developed the Scandinavian country reports as a template and a large analytical framework in a big Excel sheet with extremely detailed levels of analysis. So then in June, we had a workshop with the project team, a 2-day workshop where we went through all the policy areas and operationalized and categorized and discussed how can we compare these areas across the different countries. It was not an easy task, but we made it. Then each of the countries wrote their individual country reports and filled out the analytical form before they handed this into NIBR, which made the first draft of the comparative analysis. And then afterwards, there were 2 rounds of quality assurance with the country experts so they can ensure that their country had been categorized and classified and interpreted right in the comparative analysis. So there, with this short time frame and the extensive comparative scope, we also had to make some limitations. So this report is first and foremost a descriptive analysis. So we don't look into the drivers of change. Why have there been policy changes, the implementation challenges, or the intended or unintended effects of different policies? Furthermore, this is a description of national policies, so we don't get into the details of different regional or local practices within each country. And finally, the main focus is on protection seekers and those who have been granted protection. So we don't look at all immigrant groups, and it has also been a scope limitation that we don't look at the appeal process or the policies related to those who have their protection permit rejected. But today we launched no less than 10 reports from this project. So the main report, which I will present today, is a comparative analysis. But I wanted to give a little insight into how the different reports relate to one another. For in this project, we have strived to combine both a broad comparator perspective with, but at the same time also give the necessary details and contextual factors in for those who are interested. So the main focus in the comparator report is systematic analysis across the eight countries for each of the different areas. But however, in such comparative analysis, simplification and context simplification is needed, and you sometimes have to sacrifice context and the details. So this is provided in the individual country reports. So we also follow in the comparator report and the individual country reports, we have the same structure, the same main headings for the 11 policy areas. So if you find a topic or a finding particularly interesting in the comparative analysis for integration measures in Germany in 2015 or permanent residency requirements in Denmark in 2020, then you can look into the national report and just find that heading and that topic in the national report to get more details. And the country reports also provide more details and references to legislation, other studies, previous studies, and more context about the governance system, the political situation in that country, and a little bit about the immigration history of that country. And lastly, the main comparator report also include comparative statistical analysis of asylum flows and granted protection. However, statistical analysis on integration outcomes across countries are more challenging. And my colleagues at NIBR, Christian Tronstad and Christian Tvedt, has written a method note where they discuss the challenges of comparative analysis of integration outcomes across European countries. So this is a little gift to all of the fellow statistic nerds out there. But enough about the project and the reports. Let's get into business. So first, a little bit of background. This figure portrays the number of asylum applicants illustrated by the red diamonds, and these are not included displaced persons from Ukraine. And the blue stacks here represent those who have been granted protection, and these do include displaced persons from Ukraine. And the main picture, as we see, is variations. So the number of asylum applicants, the red diamonds, go from 100,000 in 2012 to 1 million each year in 2015 and 2016, before there was a drop because of closed borders in Europe and Corona, and it rose again, you see, in 2021 and 2022. Concerning actual granted protection, there are also large variations, ranging from 100,000 in 2012 to 5 million in 2022. And it's important to say that these figures are just until June 2023, so the actual numbers for 2023 are larger as well. And further, there are very large differences between the different countries in Europe, and here we look at the governing countries that we compare. So this figure illustrates the variation in how many protection seekers the eight countries in our analysis receive relative to its population size. So you can read about the details in the report for each country, but I just wanted to show this, to show the different that the influx is very different in each country when you compare it to population size. For example, Sweden here, the blue dotted line, had very high level of protection seekers in the years preceding 2016, and have had for traditionally many years. But you see, in this new situation from 2021, they have lower receptions compared to other European countries. On the opposite side, the orange dot here is Poland, and they have consistently had fewer asylum seekers throughout the period. But as we all know, in 2022, they have been the main receiving country. So the important takeaway is that although most of the countries have had experienced substantial increases in both these influxes, there have also been substantial differences between and large variations between countries. But let's move to the policy analysis. So we're starting with protection permits and processes. So although European countries are maybe bound by similar international regulations, they often regulate minimum standards, and they have to be transposed into the national legislation. And What we see is that, of course, the main statuses, protection permits, that the countries use are refugee status according to the UN Convention, subsidiary protection, different national variants of humanitarian status, and some countries also operate with resettlement schemes, either through the UN quota system or national resettlement schemes. And what is important is that what type of protection permit, which of these you get, can influence and be very decisive. So what kind of rights you get, connecting rights you get in the host country. And the UK stands out here a little bit because they have a variation of different types of permits with also very different connected types of rights, as we will get into as well. Concerning permits, the main finding in our analysis is that after 2015 or 2016, the protection permits got more restrictive and more temporary. So half of the countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland and Germany, introduced more restrictive criteria for obtaining certain types of permits. Austria and Sweden stopped issuing permanent residency to refugees from the start, and Denmark shortened the duration of the first-time permits, for example. So these restrictions were not part of a unified European response. Rather, as studies, early studies has described, it was more like a race to the bottom, where European countries kind of competed to not be the most attractive destination country for asylum seekers during this period of time. When it comes to permits for displaced persons from Ukraine, and in the slides from now on, I will use DPU as a shortened version of displaced persons from Ukraine. We do see a more unified European response concerning the type of permits given to this group. So the EU countries activated the temporary directive, protection directive, which gave a displaced person from Ukraine temporary protection up to 3 years. And Denmark and Norway, who is not obliged by this directive, implemented national legislation largely mirroring the same conditions as in the EU TPD. And again here, the UK is an outlier and it's the only country that is not part of the Schengen Agreement. So they have not implemented the same national legislation mirroring the EU TPD, but rather they have included three different visa schemes for Ukrainians, displaced persons from Ukraine. So it's either the Ukraine family schemes for those who have family in the UK, homes for Ukraine, which is a sponsorship scheme, or the Ukraine extension scheme for those who already resided temporarily in the UK before the full-scale invasion. But although the UK stand out a little bit, to summarize, we see a more unified European response when it comes to permits for displaced persons from Ukraine than we see in 2015. The registration and application process, there were no major changes in the main elements in 2015 and 2016, although most countries, of course, upscaled capacity and did a lot of administrative changes. However, in 2022, the temporary protection permit implied larger changes in the registration application process. For the Nordic countries, they channeled the applications through the regular asylum system, where they formally had to apply for protection. And although there was definitely a simplified procedure and a lot of online registration or automatic processing of applications. So it did work a lot faster than the regular asylum procedure. In Germany, Poland and Austria, they did not channel it through the regular asylum system, but they made simplified registration procedures. And as said, in the UK, they are not part of the Schengen, so there the displaced persons from Ukraine had to apply before they entered the country to the UK. So we see here a variety of approaches for how to register and or apply for temporary protection in the 8 countries. Moving to family reunification and permanent residency requirements. So first, family reunification rules are very complex, and they have undergone various changes the recent decade. In all the countries, except for the UK, you see that if you have a refugee status, you are exempted from the normal family reunification requirements for if you apply within 3 to 6 months. After 2015, Norway and Poland kept the same rules, but the other six countries made different restrictions. But they only made restrictions for those who had been granted subsidiary protection permits, so not for all groups. But for this group, four countries, Denmark, Sweden, Germany, and Austria, introduced a temporary suspension in the right to apply for family reunification, so you can only apply after 1 to 3 years after you got your permit. Germany and Austria also included yearly quotas for this group. So there were maximum quotas of how many who could apply for family reunification. And Finland also introduced an income requirement specifically for this group, where the sponsor had to have a required income to be able to have family reunification. In 2022, the family reunification policies has now been a salient topic for displaced persons from Ukraine, as the routes from Ukraine to European countries are shorter, and because they can travel visa-free in the Schengen area, there are legal routes to other European countries. And so the need to reunify has not been so relevant, because most family members can, in fact, reunify themselves. So this has not been a major issue this time around, at least not yet. When it comes to permanent residency, there have been these rules are generally more applied for all groups of immigrants. But in the report, we compared these four requirements. So the most common requirement is residence requirements. And in Finland, UK, and partly in Sweden, this remained the main criterion for obtaining permanent residency. So in five of the eight countries, the minimum residence periods, how long you had to live in the country before you could apply for permanent residency, were extended during the period, and particularly after 2015. So Sweden introduced first, gave them permanent residency. Now they had to live there for 3 years. Denmark and Germany both restricted or extended the residence time they had to have during this period. And Norway and the UK introduced more restrictive requirements in 2020 and 2022. And Germany, Sweden, and Denmark also introduced different types of kind of fast tracks that you can get a shorter period of time before getting a permanent residency if you had exceptional integration criteria or were employed. In all these countries, the collective temporary protection or the UK visa schemes do not count as residence time, or it's not a path to permanent residency with the permits that displaced persons from Ukraine have. So the path to permanent residency for this group is currently unknown, and it will be very interesting to see how the countries will tackle this question forward, if the war is prolonged. With the exception of Finland and the United Kingdoms, the other states also use integration requirements to obtain a permanent residency that take form an economic or language or civic related requirements. So there have been restrictions here during this period in 2015 across the board. So Norway, Poland, and Sweden introduced new economic requirements after 2015, and the other countries tightened them. Five out of eight countries have language requirements, and almost all tighten this or heighten these levels during this period of time. And half of the countries introduced civic test as a requirement for obtaining permanent residency during this time period. But for displaced persons from Ukraine, again, this has not been a salient topic because the permit doesn't even qualify for a permanent residency. In times of high influxes, the immediate accommodation and later on more stable settlement and housing is one of the most acute challenges. So how are the countries dealt with this challenge? So concerning initial accommodation, the national or the state level in the federal states have the overall responsibility for protection seekers during the registration and mostly the application period. However, although some countries have nationally run reception centers, most of the countries outsource these services to either NGOs, private companies, or municipalities, for example, or a combination of this. And during the influxes of high influxes, all countries, of course, increased capacity with existing or new actors, and also an increased use of private actors for using hotels, sports arenas, conference halls, etc., to accommodate the large number of people. And during 2015, private hosts, of course, made an effort as well. But this has particularly been the case in 2022. So we see that some countries rather institutionalized arrangements for private hosts in 2022, were opening for initial funding to the hosts, for example, in Denmark, Poland and the UK. And Germany also opened a publicly led matching site between displaced persons from Ukraine and hosts that would be willing to host them. And after the initial reception, what, if any, strategies and distribution mechanisms do the countries have to where and how protection seekers or beneficiaries may settle in the host country? So in the report, we kind of separate between two main questions. So the first question is relates to whether the protection seeker may settle wherever they want in the country if they find own housing without losing rights to financial assistance or integration measures. And this relates to a dilemma between individual choice and public steering. And before 2015, only Norway and Denmark had clearly restrictive rights or restrictions on self-settlement without losing your rights to financial assistance or integration measures. And you see, in Germany, they introduced this as a restriction for self-settlement for persons who relied on financial public assistance. The second question relates to who those who cannot find own housing or the publicly steered settlement model. And it relates to a question of national steering and distribution versus local autonomy for the municipalities. And the country split into two here. So about half of the countries have the central government allocating protection holders to municipalities in Denmark and Sweden or the federal states in Austria and Germany. The other countries in Norway, Finland, UK and Sweden before 2016, the central government and the local government enter into agreements on settling the protection seekers in their municipality. And Poland is an outlier here because they have no national distribution strategy. And this could probably be because before 2022, they had very few asylum seekers. So we see that the main principles in the settlement models have remained rather stable, except for the change in Germany and Sweden. And the main solution for displaced persons in Ukraine, as I mentioned, have been a lot of private accommodation. But there have also been some more liberal settlement practices for this group. So in Austria, they were not part of the national distribution system. In Denmark, they used other distribution criteria to distribute across the country. And there have also been more flexible legislation and practices for self-settlement without losing rights to, for example, financial assistance in, for example, Germany, Denmark and Norway. This was the first taste of selected findings focusing on permits and the initial process after arriving to the country. And these areas are most commonly the responsibility of the National Immigration Services. And I very much look forward to the reflection on these topics for our first guest. So I give the floor to you, Kristin.
Thank you, Linda. Now we have Frode Forfang. He is director at UDI, the Norwegian Directorate of Immigration. And we are very happy to have you here to answer some
Thank
questions.
You.
So first, are there any surprising or particularly interesting findings, such as different policies or practices in other countries compared to the Norwegian approach?
Yeah. I've been in the business so long that I'm not surprised by anything. but there are different approaches. And what is interesting to see is that despite the fact that all countries are bound by some international obligations, for instance, the UN Convention, but also for the majority of the countries, some EU legislation and Norway, which is not part of the EU, are still aligning very closely with the EU legislation. Even though there are some common rules, I see that there are still quite major policy change or policy differences between countries, both policy differences, but also the way we are handling on administrative level the influxes. So there are quite a lot of differences between the countries.
Yes, and you have led the Norwegian Directorate of Immigration, both in 2015 and in 2022. So, what are the main challenges in these situations, and what have been the main differences?
Well, first of all, there are major differences between the two situations. 2015 was one thing. The Ukraine situation is quite a different thing. When it comes to Ukraine, it's the challenges moved a little bit from the immigration authorities to the integration and municipalities and the society at large. Although we have, so of course, some pressure on the immigration authorities, I think that the situation in 2015 was much more difficult to handle. I think the main challenge is the uncertainty. We don't know how long the situation will last. We don't know how many people will come. And those two uncertainties makes it very difficult to plan. How should we staff the organization? How many reception centers, facilities should we set up? All those issues are very difficult to deal with because we don't know what the need will be just a month or 2 months ahead.
For sure. And also the report, it presents different legislations. So you have responses and solutions to these situations. And an important aim here is to be able to learn about solutions in different countries. How is this in your everyday work? I mean, do UDI have a regular contact with other immigration services where you can share experiences?
Well, we do actually have through different international fora a lot of cooperation with other European countries. Norway is an associate member of the European Asylum Agency, but we have also some other informal networks, Nordic, but also European. So we are exchanging a lot of information and experience. We are not aligning with each other because there are so many different policy approaches when it comes to asylum and protection seekers. But we have close cooperation with other countries, so we know very much about policies elsewhere and also about how they are actually on an administrative level dealing with the challenges.
That's interesting. Well, thank you, Frode, for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Vilde, she has so far presented focused on types of permits and legal status and the initial reception and accommodation. However, policies for protection seekers does not only revolve around entrance and the initial reception, as they also become new residents in the host countries. And with rights to asylum or protection, also come rights to general services as new residents. In this second part, Vilde will present more on financial and integration assistance, rights to school and healthcare, and so on, and before she moves on to some more overall trends. Let's move on to the regulations related to employment and integration measures. So, first, for employment, all the countries grant access to the labor market if you are granted protection. But as we know, the application process for protection can be lengthy. Different is if you're allowed to work during this time while the application is being processed. And then we see the countries split into two groups. So the Scandinavian countries generally have an employment ban during the application process, but it is possible to apply for a work permit during this phase, but it's often subject to very strict criteria. The other five countries operate with what we can call so-called employment bans for a specific period of time, but independent of the application, the length of the application process. So it ranged between 3 months to 12 months. And some countries also have some specific exceptions. For example, in Austria, applicants can work within specific sectors for a specific time period. And in Germany, they also had additional criteria for being able to work after this initial time period. For displaced persons from Ukraine, most countries gave this group immediate access to the labor market. But since the registration and application process happens so quickly for this group, before you're granted protection, the question of possibility to work before being granted protection is less relevant for this group. Turning to rights to integration measures. So integration happens, of course, at the local level. However, the countries differ concerning whether they are national regulations and if it's governed at the national level as well. So
all the countries except for the UK have, and the national government has some form of national integration strategy or nationally regulated integration measures. For example, introduction programs or language training. So in the UK, they had a national integration structure between 1997 and 2010, but this was abolished from 2011. And now this is mainly a regional or local responsibility and not nationally regulated or funded. The other countries, although, the national government develop and regulate a lot of the policies, but of course the implementation was executed by regional or local levels or through non-public actors, both for-profit and non-profit. And we map this in the report. And here there is a large variation in what actors are included in this multi-level implementation of integration services. There are very different type of scope of integration measures, all from introduction programs, language training and requirements, and civic courses. And I'm not going to get into the details of the differences in all countries, but it's in the report. But we can say that before 2015, the UK and Austria were the only ones who didn't have this nationally regulated. And in 2017, Austria joined the other club and introduced obligatory national language training. So what is interesting is that the countries have a very different approach concerning if displaced persons from Ukraine have the same rights and obligation for integration measures as other groups of protection seekers. So in Denmark and Norway and Finland, the displaced persons from Ukraine mainly get the same rights to integration measures as other protection-seeking groups. In Sweden, Poland, Germany, Austria, displaced persons from Ukraine do not have the rights to such integration measures. So they can, of course, be offered courses from local NGOs or local governments, but this depends on local capacity and availability. When it comes to financial assistance, a direct cross-national comparison of the absolute level of financial assistance is not something we want to do because it's extremely challenging and it depends on fluctuating currencies, it depends on the living cost in each country and what services and products that are included and different welfare systems in general. So we do not compare the absolute financial levels, but we compare different types and solutions or arrangements for this group and if there are differences between subgroups. So one main difference is whether the financial assistance is mean tested or an individual benefit. So in Sweden, Norway and Poland, the protection seeker who participate in an introduction program gets an individual integration benefit. In Finland, Denmark and Germany, they get regular mean tested social benefits if they are eligible for this support. And it depends on the financial situation as a whole. And in UK and Austria, there are very selective rights. So some permits are given different types of financial support. And in Austria, there are also very different regional practices on what kind of financial support the different groups get. When it comes to financial support for displaced persons from Ukraine, you see four different paths in the countries. So the UK and Germany, displaced persons in Ukraine are included in the regular social benefits system. So they get social benefits if they're eligible. In Denmark and Norway, displaced persons from Ukraine get the same rights as other groups of protection seekers. But in Sweden, Austria, and Finland just for the first year though, displaced persons from Ukraine continue on asylum seeker benefits, which is lower than other benefits, even after they are granted protection. And Poland has a mixture of different arrangements if they are not just included in the social benefit system. So we see that here there are very different solutions in the countries for displaced persons from Ukraine. And in some countries, displaced persons from Ukraine get lower benefits than other groups that have been granted protection. So what about healthcare services then? So international regulations, the Refugee Convention and the TPD, for example, state that medical care should be provided to asylum seekers and protection holders, but the full scope of this coverage depends or should be implemented in each country. And further, of course, the eight countries have very different healthcare systems. So we don't compare absolute rights here either, but we compare if the protection seekers have the similar rights as other residents in the country, or if there are differences between groups. So in all the countries, all protection seekers who are entitled to emergency healthcare during the application process. And minors have access to primary and specialist healthcare as well from the start. Poland, UK, and Austria also provide full rights to primary and specialist healthcare for adults during the application period, but the Scandinavian countries do not, or only partly in Finland. In Germany, the asylum procedure, if it's still pending after 15 to 18 months, then they transition to get full rights to healthcare. After being granted protection, though, all the countries provide full access to healthcare, and that is more or less on par with other residents. And there have been no major changes in this during the period of analysis, with one exception. And that is in Sweden. For in Sweden, displaced persons from Ukraine, just this group, are not entitled to other things than emergency healthcare, even after they are granted protection. And of course, this is a listing of rights and formal access, so it is not a study of the implementation and if these rights are actually fulfilled. And we know, of course, that during times of high influxes, healthcare capacity is very strained. Lastly, the last topic is schooling, because among the protection seekers, there is a large majority of, or a large part, are children. And in all countries, children seeking protection have the rights to schools, the similar rights as other minors in that country. And there are no national cross differences here between the countries, or there have been no changes in these rights during the period of analysis. However, during high influxes, we see that there are examples of often temporary amendments to existing regulation. For example, by introducing or regulating welcome or reception classes, by easing housing standards for the schools or preschools, or by postponing deadlines for the rights to receive schooling or for the deadline to enroll in schooling for the children. Further, as the absolute number of children who arrived to European countries in 2022 far exceeds previous influxes, some European countries have also made special amendments for this group particularly. So some groups have accommodated for online Ukrainian schooling in Poland, Germany, Austria, and Denmark. There have also been special Ukrainian classes in Denmark, and some have been easing the formal requirements to hire Ukrainian personnel, for example, in Germany, Poland, and Austria. So now I bombarded you with some main selected findings with a wide range of topics. So I hope I spurred your interest to, if not read the whole report, at least look into the topics that it's your field of expertise and that you're most interested in. But I wanted to end with some of the main trends we see across countries and across the influxes, using the three dimensions that I introduced in the beginning. So what has been the development? Are European countries becoming more restrictive or liberal? Are they becoming more selective or universal? Are they becoming more temporal or permanent? And let's start with the restrictive liberal dimension first. So not surprisingly, as been shown in many studies before as well, the lack of a unified European response to the influx in 2015 led to what has often been labeled this race to the bottom, to the race to the restrictive bottom. So although there are differences between countries in the exact policies that they implement, in which areas, and the exact level, all countries introduced restrictive policies in one or more of these areas for permits, legal assistance, appeal, permanent residency, family reunification, and financial assistance. But what about the situation in 2022? So European countries, as said, has met the situation in 2022 with a more unified response than earlier influxes when it comes to permits. as all countries have implemented the TPD or similar national regulations. However, our analysis also show, and as Frode mentioned, substantial differences in rights and restrictions also for this group across European countries. So this contests a little bit this unified European response that has been the story so far. And furthermore, we see a mixture of restrictive and liberal policies for this group. So the introduction of the Temporary Protection Directive is in itself an easement of requirements because it made the path to protection shorter and less extensive as it would be with an individual assessment. But also, there are examples of more liberal policies towards this group for accommodation and settlement, possibility for temporary return, or a rapid access to the labour market. However, we also see examples of more restrictive policies towards displaced persons from Ukraine when it comes to rights to integration measures, financial assistance, and in the Swedish case, healthcare rights. So, and of course, the temporary permit for Ukrainians does not qualify for permanent residency. So this is a restriction compared to other groups of protection seekers. So for displaced persons from Ukraine, our conclusion is that on the restrictive liberal dimension, European countries have had a rather dual approach. And despite a more unified solution in 2022 than 2015, there are still substantial cross-national differences related to this group. And related to this latter one, the analysis of displaced persons from Ukraine show example of more selective policies in many countries, differentiating rights between this group and other groups of protection seekers. However, this selective group, this selective trend is not new. It's more of a continuation of another phenomenon. As all countries, except Norway actually, has already before and after 2015 introduced very differentiated rights depending on what type of status, protection status, you have. And the differentiated rights can also depend on the protection status or visa, but also rights based on the probability to stay, nationality in some cases, and in the UK case recently, the mode of arrival to the country. And lastly, the introduction of temporary protection for displaced persons from Ukraine was a solution, as the name of the permit states, to quickly and temporarily provide protection for a large group. However, our analysis illustrates that the enforcements of the EU TPD could more correctly be described as a continuation of an ongoing temporary trend in many European countries for the asylum, immigration and integration policies. So we see this trend started already in 2015 when several of the countries introduced policies with a more temporary perspective in different policy areas, also for other permits. So there's shorter first-time permits, stricter requirements for obtaining permanent residency, and a stronger focus on return if the situation in the homeland would change, creating a more precarious situation for the protection beneficiaries. So to conclude, the analysis show an overall trend of increased temporariness already from 2015 and the years after. And this trend, of course, has intensified after 2022. So one important question going forward, both politically and academically, is how this increased temporary focus affect more long-term integration and the protection beneficiaries if they actually turn out to stay in the country. Because early studies have shown that it is difficult to have both this mentality of return and to integrate in the host country at the same time. And with that final reflection, I will look forward to hearing the thoughts from our final guests, and I give the word back to you, Kristin.
Yes, thank you, Vilde. Because with us from Paris, we have Thomas Liebig, a senior migration specialist at the International Migration Division, OECD. Thank you, Thomas, for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, even if it's only virtual.
Thank you. Supposed to be up there. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry, Thomas, you disappeared from the screen behind me, but I will talk to you on the computer here.
That's perfect.
Okay, thank you. The report compares responses in 2015 and 2022. Have Europe been better prepared this time around, and what are the main cross-national differences?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, when I look at the report, it actually has three elements, right? Or two elements. It compares the reaction between 2015 and 2022, but also the trends over time, as Wilde has just explained, between 2015 until 2022. And in terms of trends, we observe greater restrictions, but also better integration support. There have been some lessons learned that you basically need to give some upfront support, often even already during the asylum phase, as long periods of inactivity and not doing anything and not even learning the language or getting anything is not the best and is not even hampering necessarily return for those who have to return. We have also seen the trend of complementary pathways. So as a safe pathway, safe complementary pathway to protection. And actually the numbers have been pretty impressive in Europe since 2010 in total, among the main origin countries of refugees. That was in Europe as a total. We have monitored this from the OECD side together with our colleagues from the UNHCR, more than 1 million people who have obtained this complementary protection. And that's obviously mainly through the family permits, but also through study and work permits. So that's non-negligible numbers. So when we compare then the Ukraine flows with the 2015-16 flows, I'm like, first of all, question is, how can we actually compare this well? And as has been outlined very well, because the flows are so different, the situation is so different. In the case of 2015-16, it was predominantly a man without a family or who left the family behind. In the case of Ukraine, it was predominantly women, often with small children, relatively high education levels, whereas in 2015-16, it was a lot more mixed. It depended a lot on the origin countries. The refugees from Ukraine, they had networks to build upon. And obviously, also, as was mentioned before, the destination countries are greatly different, predominantly Central and Eastern Europe with the Baltics, and only some overlap in the main destination countries, notably Germany, but also to some lesser degree, Austria, Norway, and even lesser overlap in the case of Sweden. So when we look at what was done better, I make one and one can certainly highlight, first of all, that there was a European response, perhaps not completely unified, as Wilde said, but it was certainly a lot stronger and combined than it was the case in 2015-16. Also, the issue of labor market access, the issue of immediate labor market access, that was granted. That was not the case for many good reasons to the people who arrived in 15 and 16 because they have arrived in the asylum system and asylum seekers rarely get a labor market access right upon arrival. And also more generally, there was the impression that things were under control. You didn't see these pictures that you had seen with people also sleeping in certain centers or coming massively through certain bottlenecks. It was these pictures you didn't see for many reasons because people came by buses and elsewhere. But that certainly also from the point of the images that were created left a different impression upon the public. But obviously for reasons that are linked to the very different nature of the flows. Also interesting is the issue of housing. I mean, we're in a huge housing shortage, and when we talk to policymakers across Europe in particular, everybody says the issue of housing. That said, we didn't see these housing solutions at least pretty rarely in town halls or whatever. But it was often private solutions, and that was partly also because of the networks that the Ukrainians had and that other groups didn't have. And obviously, there was also better support infrastructure on which to build, mainly in the destinations, Norway, Germany, Austria, and Sweden. There had been improvements in the reception infrastructure post 2015-16, and that obviously was possible to build upon, but not necessarily elsewhere. I mean, Poland and the other Central and Eastern European countries, they had a lot less infrastructure to build upon. And as a result of this whole issue, we saw better integration outcomes. It was pretty remarkable, the employment rates that you see for the refugees from Ukraine, according to the first figures that we have. They are much better than the 2015 ones in the early phase. And the 2015-16 ones were already much better than previous refugee rates. So we see that positive trend in integration outcomes as well.
Yes. And you were mentioning the public there, because the report finds that civil society, they play a crucial role in these situations. But what do we know about changes in the public opinion during this time period?
Well, one of the key findings is that there was a remarkable stability of public opinion. I mean, when you talk to anybody on the street, people would generally say, well, public opinion is just going down the hill, and it's turned largely negative. But in general, the research that's out, it actually shows a remarkable stability in public opinion. There's still there's still a great willingness to help people in need, and to provide support to these people in need. And if anything, if you compare 2010 with 2020, so pre 2015 and post 2015, in some countries there was even an increase. For example, in Germany, it will be interesting, obviously, to monitor how the very strong flows also of last year of the renewed asylum seekers, how this is affecting that. But we see a remarkable stability, and that's all what the research shows. And we also see that civil society has been extremely active in both cases.
Yes. Well, thank you, Thomas, so much for being able to call in from Paris today. Thank you.
Thanks to you.
What are the great dilemmas for all the countries going forward now? Well, if we first look at the situation with displaced persons from Ukraine, so we see that although there has been a more unified response, there are, as we see, substantial cross-national differences. And there's only 1 year left of the 3-year permit that is the European solution so far. So what will happen after that? We see now in Norway that the last couple of months, Norway has received a relatively larger share of displaced persons from Ukraine compared to other Nordic countries. And we do see a shift in the public debate. The government has introduced and proposed more restrictions towards this group. So what will be interesting to follow is whether the European countries will continue to have this more solidarity and unified approach to this group, or whether we will actually see the start of another race to the restrictive bottom also for this group. A second important opinion is, I want to stress, is the temporary perspective. So as we've shown in our analysis, this is not just relevant for displaced persons from Ukraine, but the precarious status and the uncertainty and temporal permits has become a more normal situation for all groups of protection seekers in most countries. So how this precarious status and this temporary status affect the individual human beings and their integration into society and the labor market is a very important question going forward, because as we know, the majority of protection seekers actually stay in the host country because wars seldom end fast. So I think this is the important question for further academic scrutiny, but also public debate.
Yes. Thank you, Vilde.
Thank you.
And thank you, all of you who have followed this webinar. The report will be sent to you on a link by email. And this webinar has been recorded and will be available at the Oslo Met film page. And lastly, we hope you all continue to have a very pleasant day. Thank you.